Jute community is in utter desperation as intimidation, detention, deportation and night raids have become the order of the day. The Indian government calls them a security threat and prone to radicalization. For decades, the minority community faced systematic persecution at home in Buddhist-majority Myanmar. In recent years, the UN has accused Myanmar of genocide after hundreds of thousands fled to neighboring Bangladesh. Rights activists say the ruling BJP is fueling resentment since it won election in 2014. It calls the Rohingya a security threat, while the policy for refugees from other countries remains different. Persecuted Rohingya Muslims are being treated as illegal immigrants wherever they have settled after fleeing carnage in Myanmar. They are now living in makeshift camps as refugees across different parts of South Asia, especially in India, Bangladesh and Malaysia. Activists in India have stressed the urgent need to protect their rights as refugees. They urge the Indian government to formulate a uniform refugee policy to treat refugees equally, regardless of caste, ethnicity or faith.
On the third day of a public mourning in the southern Iranian city of Shiraz, following a terrorist attack on the holy shrine of Shah Cheragh, a huge crowd of people from different walks of life took part in the funeral procession of the victims.
I tell the enemies that we support the establishment and no one can harm it. We will be victorious.
I came to this rally to show that we are united. Iranian people should support each other and stay united so that Iran does not turn into a country like Syria.
At least 15 people were confirmed dead in the terrorist attack on Wednesday, among them women and children.
If you were truly courageous, you would fight in the battlefield, just like what General Soleimani did. But you attack a holy religious place and kill women and children. This is inhumane.
Tens of thousands of mourners from different walks of life took part in the event. Holding pictures of the victims and chanting slogans, the participants condemned terrorism and those behind the vicious act of terror in Shiraz.
It was our duty to take part in this event, and I tell the terrorists who committed this crime that killing us would only make the Iranian nation more conscious.
The mourners also chanted slogans against the supporters of Daesh terrorist group, particularly the United States and Israel. The coffins of the martyrs were then flown to the northeastern city of Mashhad, which houses the mausoleum of 8th Shia Imam Imam Reza, where thousands of mourners bid farewell to the victims.
Shedding the blood of innocent civilians in a religious holy shrine is a heinous crime denounced by people globally. Presence of a huge crowd of people in the funeral of martyrs of Shiraz terror attack shows the Iranian nation's unity in the face of enemies who seek to undermine the country's security. Mahdi Abbasian, Shiraz.
The elegant streets of historic Sevastopol. Ukraine and NATO still claim this city and the rest of Crimea as part of Ukraine, despite the 2014 referendum on joining Russia. Down by the harbour, I wanted to know how people feel about Ukrainian threats of taking back this city.
Crimea is not baggage to transfer in and out. People don't want to return to Ukraine, and they never identified as Ukrainian.
I don't want Crimea to return to Ukraine. We are Russian. We speak Russian. We were raised as Russian, and we have Russian culture. I was born in 1986, and never in my life did I feel myself Ukrainian. I have Ukrainian citizenship, but all my life I considered myself Russian and living in a Russian city.
My personal opinion was Crimea was Russian and remains Russia. I'm an ordinary man and this is my opinion. It will be bad if someone wants to take away Crimea. But I'm against the war that is going on. It's terrible what is going on in my beloved Russia.
A Russian fighter jet flies overhead, a common occurrence, perhaps returning from a combat mission in Kherson. Sometimes cruise missiles can be seen from the harbour, fired by Russia's Black Sea Fleet, which is based in the city.
Let them dream. It's not harmful to dream. We are at home. Nobody asked our opinion when Crimea became part of Ukraine. We were forced to become Ukrainian citizens. 30 years later, we returned home. We were tormented and were worried. Ukrainians were treating us badly. Everyone here is Russian.
Soviet leader Nikita Khrushchev gave Crimea to Ukraine in 1954. Many see that as a historic mistake, not reflective of the wishes of locals.
Now, I have found a couple of people who are more pro-Ukrainian. They don't want to say their views openly, and they do tend to be from a younger demographic born after the fall of the Soviet Union. But even amongst that age group, they are very much in the minority.
So Ukraine and NATO say that they want to take back Crimea from Russia. How do you feel about that?
I wish you good luck. Let's try. They can try, but they won't at all. It's a Russian place. What can I say more?
So we are Russians.
While Russia and Ukraine continue to claim this city as their own, one thing is not in doubt. The vast majority of people living here want to be part of the Russian Federation. Zhenimel, Sevastopol, Crimea.
South Korean President Yoon Suk-yeol has been under pressure for his hardline policy against North Korea as tensions increase amid renewed large-scale military exercises with the U.S. This week, he sought to reassure the National Assembly and the public.
We will strengthen deterrence against North Korea with overwhelming capabilities through combined defense posture between South Korea and the U.S. and the trilateral security cooperation between South Korea, the U.S., and Japan, so that our people can continue their daily lives without worry.
Progressive civil society worries the Korean Peninsula has fallen into crisis, with unification becoming more and more remote. They oppose the military exercises, demanding an end to the drills and a rethinking of South Korea's alliance with the United States.
From the 31st, the South Korean and U.S. forces will conduct the largest ever joint air war exercise in Korea, with 250 Air Force units deployed to strike hundreds of strategic bases in North Korea at the same time. The Korean Peninsula should not be an outpost for American hegemony in the world. This land should not be an American war base.
The U.S.-South Korea drills have continued since the end of August, following North Korea's testing of dozens of ballistic missiles. South Korea this week staged a large-scale amphibious landing drill. North Korea views such military exercises as a rehearsal for invasion. South Korean President Yoon Suk-yeol has emphasized the need for the U.S. to show a strong commitment toward extended deterrence, the so-called nuclear umbrella. But that may not be enough, with stronger conservative voices here calling for South Korea to develop its own nuclear weapons. Frank Smith, Seoul.
Lebanon and Israel have finalized a U.S. brokered deal aimed at resolving a maritime dispute. President Michel Aoun signed a letter on Thursday endorsing the agreement. The final paperwork was submitted to the United Nations in Naqoura, southern Lebanon, concluding a long path of indirect negotiations with the Israeli regime. Separately, the Israeli cabinet, led by Prime Minister Yair Lapid, also approved the agreement. The regime's representative then delivered the signed copy to the UN at the Naqoura point. Hezbollah Secretary General stressed in a brief statement that the deal is a victory for Lebanon's government, people, and resistance. Nasrallah also declared the end of Hezbollah's exceptional mobilization over the maritime dispute, saying the resistance movement had accomplished its mission regarding the issue. Hezbollah leaders said the agreement is not an international treaty.
What happened in Naqoura is not normalization with Israel. This deal is not an international treaty and is not a recognition of Israel. Israel itself has admitted it received no security guarantees.
U.S. Envoy Amos Hochstein, who was with the Lebanese delegation in the southern Lebanese town of Naqoura, had met the top Lebanese officials.
I truly believe and hope that this can be an economic turning point in Lebanon for a new era of investment and continued support to lift up the economy and make sure that whatever arrangements happen, they're done openly transparently and making sure that the benefits are felt directly by all the Lebanese people.
Experts believe this agreement would put Lebanon on the map of natural gas exporters. President Michel Aoun stressed in his statement that demarcating the southern maritime border is a technical matter that has no political implications and won't change his country's policy towards the Israeli regime. U.S. President Joe Biden has hailed the maritime border deal as a historic breakthrough. For Lebanon, it unlocks the possibility to exploit its own natural resources at a time when the West is seeking gas suppliers and looking for alternatives to Russian gas. Maryam Saleh, Naqoura, South Lebanon.
Many millions of people living across the 27-nation EU are struggling to survive. Brussels resident Jefferson Araujo has endured two rent increases since March. His landlord says her mortgage is going up, and so a further rent hike is needed.
You go to the market, you cannot buy anything anymore because the price is too high. And I'm thinking maybe to leave Brussels because I'm working in a hotel 10 hours a day. Like sometimes I have just one day off a week.
In an attempt to bring down soaring inflation, the European Central Bank, which manages the euro, has announced interest rates are going up by a further 75 basis points. That represents a huge increase for people repaying home loans. The economic outlook could get even worse, the ECB warns.
Confidence could deteriorate further, and supply-side constraints could worsen again. Energy and food costs could also remain persistently higher than expected.
Some EU leaders have warned the ECB that increasing interest rates so aggressively could push the eurozone into a deep recession. Higher rates impede business expansion and employment. Charities fighting social injustice often point out all of those taking the decisions that lead to higher inflation and interest rates are insulated from the impact simply because they are the richest individuals in society. Critics say the EU's move to cut out Russia's cheap gas over the war in Ukraine is backfiring. Despite this, a ninth round of sanctions against Moscow is being prepared.
The Commission and the EES are obviously constantly working in the context of the sanctions on making sure that we are ready should there be a need for further sanctions.
Peace seems to be a dirty word in Western capitals. This as the US weapons and energy sectors make enormous profits, while ordinary EU citizens pay a very high price. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Iranians have held nationwide rallies to condemn the Wednesday terrorist attack in the southern city of Shiraz. The protesters took to the streets in different cities following Friday prayers. They chanted slogans and held banners, calling for the perpetrators and their backers to be brought to justice.
Today, we're here to show the world that we are all together. We are a powerful country. We're going to fight against terrorism. We're going to fight against violence. You want us to be separated. You want us to fight against each other, but we are the one. We are powerful.
At least 13 people, including two children, were killed after gunmen opened fire on pilgrims at the Shah Charagh Holy Shrine in Shiraz. 26 others were wounded. The Daesh terror group claimed responsibility shortly after the attack.
We strongly condemn any acts of terrorism and desecration of Muslim sanctities. We want to say that we hate London-based news channels like Iran International, Manoto, and BBC because they are instigating violence and unrest in Iran.
We are here to send this message to Israel, the U.S., and their allies that through creating riots and unrest in the country, they cannot achieve their sinister goal of disintegration of Iran. We are united.
Leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, has called on security agencies, the judiciary, intellectuals, activists, and the entire nation to act in unison to confront the current which is disregarding and disrespecting people's lives, security, and sanctities. Meanwhile, Iran's President Ebrahim Raisi has also vowed that the Islamic Republic would deliver a crushing response to those who were behind the bloodshed.
The ralliers have called on Iranian authorities to prosecute the main perpetrators of the heinous crime of terrorist attack in Shiraz. and take all necessary measures to maintain security in the country as soon as possible. Saman Kujuri, Tehran.
In the limelight.
The United Nations, in its recent report, has warned that the planet could see cataclysmic 2.9 degrees Celsius of heating by 2100. In this regard, we have taken a look at some world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for more. Common Dreams wrote, a United Nations report published recently ahead of November's COP27 talks warns that planetary heating could reach a catastrophic 2.9 degrees Celsius by the end of the century without immediate action from the world's largest polluters to dramatically rein in carbon emissions and transition away from fossil fuels. The analysis by the UN Framework Convention on Climate Change, UNFCCC, examines the climate commitments of the 193 national parties to the Paris Climate Accord, which sets out to limit warming to 1.5 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial levels, an amount of heating that would still have devastating impacts across the world, particularly in poor and low-lying nations. Even if countries meet their current climate targets, something many nations are not on track to achieve as climate advocates and scientists push for bolder actions, including the U.S. regime, global carbon emissions are projected to rise 10.6% by 2030 relative to 2010 levels, and the planet is set to warm by an average of 2.1 to 2.9 degrees Celsius by 2100. The latest UN report is another reminder that we are still just throwing cups of water at a raging inferno. Jamie Henn, director of Fossil Free Media, wrote on Twitter, adding, it's past time for U.S. President Joe Biden to declare a climate emergency and use every power he has to get us off fossil fuels. The report notes that while some progress has been made toward reducing planet warming emissions over the past year, an urgent need for either a significant increase in the level of ambition of nationally determined contributions between now and 2030 or a significant overachievement of climate action plans will be necessary to avert disastrous warming. The New York Times noted that just 26 of 193 countries that agreed last year to step up their climate actions have followed through with more ambitious plans. The downward trend in emissions expected by 2030 shows that nations have made some progress this year, said Simon Steele, the executive secretary of UN Climate Change, adding, but the science is clear, and so are our climate goals under the Paris Agreement. We are still nowhere near the scale and pace of emission reductions required to put us on track towards a 1.5 degrees Celsius world. Steele added, to keep this goal alive, national governments need to strengthen their climate action plans now and implement them in the next 8 years. The report was published as extreme weather made more intense by the climate emergency continues to ravage large swathes of the globe. taking lives, destroying communities, and exacerbating the intertwined crises of poverty, hunger, and inequality. Millions are reeling from devastating flooding in Nigeria and Pakistan, while East Africa is in the midst of a starvation crisis intensified by prolonged drought. The potential impacts of 2.9 degrees Celsius of warming are stark. As Scott Culp, a computational scientist at Climate Central, told BuzzFeed last year, an estimated 12% of the current global population living on land could be threatened under long-term future sea level rise under the 3 degrees Celsius scenario, Culp noted, so that amounts to 810 million people. Another expert, Rutgers University climate scientist Robert Cobb, told the outlet that the more we push the system above 2 degrees Celsius, but we don't know how much, the more the chance we trigger ice sheet processes that could rapidly increase sea level rise. Sema Shukri, Egypt's Minister of Foreign Affairs and President's designate of the upcoming COP27 talks, said in a statement that the new UNFCCC report is further testimony to the fact that we are off track on achieving the Paris climate goal and keeping the 1.5 degrees within reach. Shukri said raising ambition and urgent implementation is indispensable for addressing the climate crisis. This includes cutting and removing emissions faster and at wider scope of economic sectors to protect us from more severe adverse climate impacts and devastating loss and damage. This is a sobering moment, and we are in a race against time. Several of those who are expected to do more are far from doing enough, and the consequences of this is affecting lives and livelihoods across the globe. I am conscious that it is and should be a continuum of action until 2030 and 2050. However, these alarming findings merit a transformative response at COP27. Al Jazeera English also had an eye on this issue, writing, "The planet is heading for climate catastrophe. The UN has warned, as a report showed, how far off track nations are on cutting global warming pollution." The UN Environment Programme, UNEP, released its annual emissions gap report showing that current commitments by governments to curb the rise of global temperature are woefully inadequate. Current government climate policies leave the world on track to reach an average 2.8 degrees Celsius temperature rise this century, the report said, while implementation of current pledges will lower the rise of temperature to 2.4 to 2.6 degrees Celsius this century. Government officials will meet from November 6 to 18th at the COP27 climate talks in Egypt to discuss how to limit the warming to below 2 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial levels, and ideally to 1.5 degrees Celsius. Last year, leaders made additional pledges at the COP26 summit in Glasgow, hoping to reduce emissions. Since the climate talks in Scotland, additional commitments were made to remove 5/10 gigatons of carbon dioxide equivalent greenhouse gas emissions, less than 1% of estimated global emissions in 2030, the annual UN Environment Programme report showed. Policies in place without a strengthening will likely lead to a 2.8 degrees Celsius rise in temperature by the end of the century, 1/10 degree Celsius higher than was estimated last year. UNEP Executive Director Ignar Andersson said, "We had our chance to make incremental changes, but that time is over. Only a root and branch transformation of our economies and societies can save us from accelerating climate disaster." to reach the goal of limiting warming to 1.5 degrees Celsius, annual emissions must be reduced by 45% compared with emissions forecast under current policies. The move requires the investment of at least $4 to $6 trillion a year, the report said. It's another year squandered in terms of currently actually doing something about the problem. That's not to say that all nations have not taken this seriously, but from a global perspective, it's definitely very far from adequate, report lead author Anne Olhoff said. According to a separate UN report earlier this week, analyzing the latest pledges submitted by countries, 2.5 degrees Celsius of warming is likely by the end of the century. Simon Steele, Executive Secretary of UN Climate Change, in a statement said, "We are still nowhere near the scale and pace of emission reductions required to put us on track toward a 1.5 degrees Celsius world." Under the 2015 Paris deal, countries are required to submit ever deeper emission-cutting plans known as Nationally Determined Contributions, or NDCs. UNEP found that unconditional NDCs, which countries plan regardless of external support, would likely limit global warming to 2.6 degrees Celsius by 2100, a level that scientists warn would be catastrophic for humanity and for nature. Conditional NDCs, which rely on international funding to achieve, would likely see a 2.4 degrees Celsius temperature rise this century. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres stressed that carbon neutrality goals are useless if not backed by action, adding that the world cannot afford any more greenwashing. Commitments to net zero are worth zero without the plans, policies, and actions to back it up, he said in a video message. Global and national climate commitments are falling pitifully short, Guterres said in the video, which comes less than 2 weeks before the start of COP27. Guterres said, in other words, we are headed for a global catastrophe.
We are with you. What about you? Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
Now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Lebanon is without a president. Lebanon's outgoing head of state, Michel Aoun, has vacated the presidential palace one day before his mandate expired without a designated successor. To further deepen the political crisis in that country, Aoun also has said that he signed a decree formalizing the resignation of Najib Mikati's caretaker government, this on top of the economic woes of the country. In this edition of The Spotlight, we will look at how Lebanon just averted a war with the signing of a historic maritime deal, one in which Israel was left with no choice but to sign without Lebanon formalizing ties with it, unlike other Persian Gulf Arab regimes.
History repeats itself once more in Lebanon as President Michel Aoun steps out of a presidential palace, which will remain vacant for an unknown period of time.
addressing flocks of supporters, Aoun said a chapter has ended in Lebanon's politics and a new chapter will begin.
A new phase begins, and this new phase requires struggle and work to exit our crises. The country is looted, and we have to carry out a lot of efforts to uproot corruption.
Aoun talked about the recent agreement with Israel to demarcate Lebanon's maritime borders. He said the deal secured the nation's access to its natural resources, adding that the future revenues should be used to repair the Lebanese economy.
The demarcation of our maritime border will allow us to extract the national treasure of petrol and gas, which would grant us the needed capital to come out of our economic and financial crisis. We hope to see a sovereign fund that would be used for development and also for the upcoming generations.
Aoun took office in 2016. His was marred by mass protests, a severe economic crisis, and currency collapse, and the August 2020 portside blast that killed hundreds.
President Michel Aoun ends his term today at a time when Lebanon is deeply divided on various issues, but it was this term that has given Lebanon what experts are calling a golden opportunity to become a gas exporter and salvage its economy.
President Aoun does not only leave behind a country without a head of state, but he goes back to his residency. The political divide remains quite entrenched, and experts see that the maritime border deal proves that the West has lifted its undeclared blockade on Lebanon.
In Lebanon, we are not usually good at seizing opportunities, but we benefited from the opportunity of demarcating the maritime border. Since there was a Western interest in having a stability in the Mediterranean region and allowing Lebanon to extract its resources. But will the Lebanese seize this opportunity to form an agreement which could result in the election of a president? We are waiting for the upcoming hours, which could evolve into security threats or perhaps surprises.
Lebanese lawmakers have failed to agree on electing a successor for Aoun, with no side having a clear majority to impose a candidate to succeed him. A caretaker government has been in place since the parliamentary elections last spring, and with no hope in forming a new cabinet in the last hours of Aoun's term, political divisions are expected to deepen until the election of a new president. Maryam Saleh, Beirut.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Let me first introduce our guest for this edition of The Spotlight. Elijah Bankner joins us. He's a journalist and political analyst from Brussels. Also joining us, Mohsen Abbas, journalist and political commentator from London. Gentlemen, welcome to you both. Elijah Bankner, first to you. Lebanon's President Michel Aoun has now left that position that he held, and the ceremony today was quite a remarkable one in terms of the turnout. Anyways, one of the problems is there is no, at this point, designated successor. So what kind of legacy, as a general question, I should ask you, has he left behind? And how do you think this void will now impact Lebanon?
Thank you for having me. This is the first time in the history of Lebanon where a president leaves the presidential palace with a resigned government. And with a total disagreement among the strong political parties, not able to form a government before the end of the president's mandate, and without the visibility that there is going to be an agreement among the political parties. So we have the strong Christian party group, the Tayar, that is the party of the president, led by his son-in-law, who has a strong party, and he has 17 to 18 MPs in the parliament and is an ally of Hezbollah, and they have created a long, strong, and robust report throughout the last years. However, the candidate to the presidency is not yet agreed upon because, as your correspondent rightly said, there is no agreement so far, and nobody holds a majority in the parliament. So the problem now is the power will go to the parliament, and the speaker is a Shia that is not going to be accepted by the Sunni community, particularly the prime minister, who is in agreement with the speaker, a Shia speaker, Nabih Berri. However, they don't agree on passing on the power from the Sunni that normally should hold the legislation. The Shia hold the legislation and the Sunni the executive power. So this kind of very strange and ambiguous situation in Lebanon needs the agreement of the major political parties that are not yet ready to sit because they have demand. And as I said, the son-in-law of the president, Jubran Basile, has demands in the new parliament. He wants six ministers, and the prime minister doesn't agree with his demand, and the whole point is to weaken Basile in the new government. So this kind of disagreement pushed Hezbollah to pull out of the government. If ever there is going to be a meeting of the called by the prime minister, and that leaves the country into very ambiguous situation. However, this is also a situation where everybody is going to be forced to sit around the table and start a serious dialogue to try and smooth the pass on of power and how to form a new government.
Well, that invitation could be maybe easy to send out, say, Mohsen Abbas, to sit around the table. But as our guest there said, neither Hezbollah has any domination in terms of a clear majority that's needed, nor its opponents. So how can this deadlock be solved, do you think?
Well, I think, common sense has to prevail. Lebanon finds itself on the border of the most imperialist force in West Asia, Israel. Lebanon needs to remember that Israel has invaded it several times and unsuccessfully, largely because of the Islamic resistance or the resistance axis itself in that region, Hezbollah particularly, obviously, on the front line. Lebanon needs to recognize that unity internally will lead to strength in terms of maintaining the sovereignty of Lebanon, because make no mistake, most of the socioeconomic woes, most of the political maneuverings that are going on have got big money behind them. Most of these people who are playing the games which keep Lebanon on a knife edge politically and economically are either in the pockets of the Americans, the Israelis, or the Saudis. There's a lot of money floating around for a lot of corrupt people in the background. Now, within all of that, Hezbollah, Amal, and others have done their level best to steer away from anything which will lead to a civil war. Because don't also forget that Lebanon was embroiled in a decades-long civil war, which was hugely bloody as well. And I think none of the Lebanese people need to be reminded of that scenario and what that entails. They can take heart and perhaps, I'd say, look towards this particular deal with Israel and look at the reasons why they were successful in terms of negotiating a maritime deal, really quite an unprecedented territorial deal with Israel. Because Israel, don't forget, never gives away borders. I mean, it considers its borders to be legitimate from the sea to the Euphrates as per their Odin Yinon plan or their periphery doctrine.
So why did they?
The fact that they've managed to force Israel into an agreement is a huge sign for the Lebanese people and themselves, that the unity of the leadership, which there was unity in this negotiation amongst the officials, and also the military power of Hezbollah in particular, both persuaded Israel to back off from the option of war, because that's what it was. When they got their Greek ship in to extract the oil from the disputed waters. It was Hezbollah who jumped in, said Nasrallah, to actually threaten Israel. So I think that there's a lot of thought and reflection they must do around the idea of unity and its benefit for the sovereignty and the independence and the existence of Lebanon.
Elijah Magner, I guess there are talks about the maritime deal and also unity. So let's break that down a little bit. First, let's take the idea of unity. It doesn't appear that there's much unity when you're having the Mikati government to remain in this caretaker role since the elections in spring, and then you have Aoun, who has formalized the decree for the resignation of Mikati's caretaker government. Can you please tell us what the problem was there, and the friction between the two?
Since President Aoun took power, and almost everybody, at the exception of Hezbollah, worked to defeat Aoun and to cripple his ruling, to tell the world that this is the worst president ever because of his unity with Hezbollah and because Aoun was promoted by Hezbollah to power, because he was a general who supported the cause of the resistance, stood against Israel overtly, stood against the Americans when they wanted to isolate Hezbollah without being an anti-American. And because of that, he needed to pay the price. So the Americans, the Saudis, and all the Gulf countries who are oil rich and they have a lot of money and they used to support Lebanon, stopped all the support, did everything to show that Aoun is the worst president. They prevented the electricity to come in the country, be provided, even when they were offered by China to rebuild the infrastructure of the country. Russia did the same. Iran offered oil through Hezbollah twice, and then now it's offering to the Lebanese government, and still the government is hesitant. Why? Because in Lebanon is divided between those who are afraid of the Americans and those who are not afraid to challenge the Americans for the benefit of the population. So Aoun is one of these people who is not afraid to say to the Americans, Hezbollah is represent the Lebanese society. It represents more than a third of the Lebanese society. It is not a group that is detached from Lebanon, is Lebanese, has nowhere else to go. And you have to live with it because he is defending the sovereignty of the country. And as your guest rightly mentioned, the maritime border, it was due to Hezbollah that this was reached. So all these imposed on the president as a heavy burden. Either you drop Hezbollah and you do what we want, or you're going to be completely isolated. And this is what happened. Now, Mikati is a businessman. He's very rich. He has his money abroad, and he is afraid of the sanctions because the Americans can exert their perfect hobby to impose sanctions on individual and country when they don't follow their own policy. Uh-huh. So because of that, Mikati needs to accommodate the Americans, and because of that, Aoun has been completely isolated, and this is why today he's leaving, and he signed just a few hours before his departure, the resignation of the government of Mikati, because Mikati wasted time not to agree on a new government to include all the strong political party because he wanted to accommodate the Americans.
Well, you would think that Mikati would have a change of stance there, Samuelson Abbas, because as you mentioned, that this was a historic deal. As many have said, this was a historic deal. But this was also a deal, and that's the issue that needs to be talked about here, which it wasn't so much that Israel had really a choice, did it? Because if it was to go ahead with what it was doing, it would face the specter of war. At the same time, then there was the decision made, and correct me if I'm wrong, the decision was, should we go to war with Hezbollah or should we not? And the decision was made, we shouldn't. The fact that they didn't, doesn't it show that Israel then was afraid to go to war because it would, in its calculations, know that it would lose that war?
Well, absolutely. I mean, the signs of Israel's relative weakness are being borne out even more by their failure to take on Hezbollah. Hezbollah very clearly put forward three unarmed drones and sent them towards the Israeli gas gas rig at that time, and Sayyid Nasrallah warned that no one would drill gas as long as the Lebanese rights to extract were not upheld. He made it absolutely clear that Hezbollah was right on the verge of being at war with Israel over this. Israel stared back at Hezbollah, and ultimately it's Israel that's blinked first, because Israel has quite clearly conceded on the disputed territories almost 100% of its initial negotiating position. You know, even Ehud Adiri, who was the lead negotiator, actually resigned 1 week before the agreement, which indicates why Benjamin Netanyahu has been talking of this deal as a capitulation to Hezbollah, specifically. You know, so clearly there's a direct link, 879 squared kilometers of oil and gas-rich territories. Israel would never give these away unless it actually feared Hezbollah's armed resistance. And Sayyid Nasrallah hasn't just taken the credit for himself on this. He's made it clear that he was supported by everybody from the Palestinian resistance, who during this period were offering a complementary resistance internally within the land of so-called Israel, but also the Yemeni resistance, the Iraqi resistance, and many others were clearly offering their support. When it looked like there was going to be potential war between Lebanon or Hezbollah and Israel, the resistance axis and the resistance front started to come together very powerfully. And I think that acknowledging that is terribly important, because for the future, what it tells us is that Israel is not up against just Hezbollah now. It has several other problems. Syria, of course, I didn't mention in the previous list, but they too were in total support. And let's not forget that Israel occupies the Golan Heights, where Genie Oil extract Syrian oil day in, day out. The Americans steal it from the west side of Syria, or rather the east side of Syria. But Genie Oil continue to extract oil from the Golan Heights, will certainly have been making huge preparations for it, and nobody has been able to take that back from them. Sure. Here, what we find is Hezbollah has stopped Israeli theft of Lebanese gas and oil.
All right, one thing that's very confusing, Elijah Magnier, Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah spoke last night, and he did speak about the fact that based on the availability of the gas or natural resources as a whole in that area, Palestine also has a share of this. But it's somewhat confusing as to how the deal was made and whether Palestine is going to get a share out of these natural resources or not, and what role would Lebanon have in this matter, or if it has been actually set aside in the deal provisions that entitle Palestine to any of those natural resources. Can you tell us what the deal is there?
This is a very tricky question. Actually, the reason why Sayyid Nasrallah and Hezbollah was not involved in the negotiation and kept some distance in many details is because there is an ideological problem here, issue that Hezbollah respects and is not ready to bypass or to close an eye on, considering that this is a Palestinian territory, it's a Palestinian sea, and this is why Hezbollah is not interfering in small details. And the biggest mistake the Israelis made is to leave these 2.3 kilometers or 2.5 kilometers that they refuse to negotiate on, because that will give more reason for Hezbollah not only to exist as a military resistance, but to say we need to liberate this part because it belonged to Lebanon, and the rest belonged to Palestine, not to the Israelis, because this deal was never signed with the Israelis. It was signed between the Israelis and the Americans, between the Lebanese and the Americans, and there is no recognition whatsoever of Israel because it is considered still as an enemy, and the territory belongs to Palestine. Now, in the deal, The deal was made with the companies that are in charge of extracting the gas, and the company will give the Lebanese share as it was agreed previously, and Lebanon has nothing to do with the benefit of what the company that are going to be in charge of extracting the gas are going to be with their share. If they give part of it to Israel or not, that is their business. This is where Hezbollah kept a distance, because Hezbollah consider all these parts need to be liberated and returned to the Palestinians because it is their legitimate land and sea.
Very well. Thank you for mentioning the fact about who signed the deal with whom, because the question that has come about is that some have said this deal amounts to Beirut recognizing Israel. And, of course, given the signatures that you said, then that clarifies that, which brings me to the final point, Sayyid Mohsen Abbas. This deal, another significant aspect of it was that Lebanon did not have to formalize its relationship when it comes to Israel the way that other Arab countries have done. How significant is that? In under a minute, please.
Well, it's very significant because ideologically, of course, the resistance stands by no normalization with Israel. They regard Israel as an illegal entity and an alien entity. And I think this, of course, has been a very, very astute move, because they can't be accused, essentially, of being hypocrites or having double standards. The war footing with Israel still exists. The disputes with Israel still exists. The non-recognition of the illegitimate nature of the colonial settler state still exists. The support for the Palestinian resistance by Hezbollah and other resistance front forces still exists. So actually nothing has changed from an ideological point of view. There is still an absolute disdain and disregard for the apartheid nature of Israel, and a disdain for the fact that they've stolen Palestinian land, and that they represent an existential threat to the security and peace of West Asia, and the primary threat to that peace. So it's as you were from that point of view, and certainly they can also point back to the likes of the United Arab Emirates, that is the Lebanese negotiators. They can say, look, this is how it's done. We can put Israel into a position of, if you like, weakness and giving, rather than the way you've operated with them, with the so-called Abraham Accords, and the way Bahrain, the UAE, and even Saudi on the quiet are all behaving towards Israel, which is to say, look, we want to do deals and do what you like. So there's a big difference, yes.
I apologize. We're fresh out of time. Sayyid Mohsen Abbas, journalist and political commentator. Elijah McNear, thank you so much. Journalist and political analyst from Brussels. With that, we'll come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Yacoba Tahwe, it's goodbye until the next Spotlight.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.